Well, welcome to day two of the B101 contract. I know that these talks get pretty dense and hard to listen to for a long period of time. After this, it'll be a lot easier for the next several weeks, I promise you. Does everybody have a copy of the revised class schedule? I know it was circulated. If not, come on up and grab one. The important thing to keep in mind is that the midterm has been pushed back a week. It was originally scheduled for March 2. Now it's March 9. So the midterm will be in class. And then we have a pizza party for the Monday after the midterm at 6 o'clock at night, or 5:30 at night or whatever, at my office in the Sears Tower. That, too, of course, is pushed back a week. So it's now the 14th rather than the 7th. So I'm hoping to see you all on March 14th. For dinner, for pizza, and to go over the midterm. But on the B101, we left off at the end of Article 4, which was the article about additional services, and now we're starting Article 5, which is the owner's responsibilities. Articles 2, 3, and 4 were all about the architect's responsibilities. And as you recall, they were long. It took a long time to go through them. I didn't see anyone quite fall asleep, but I wouldn't have totally blamed you if you had. It's a lot of information to digest, because on a construction project, the architect has a lot of services and a lot of clarification to explain what those services are and aren't. The owner has a much simpler task. The owner's primary responsibility is to pay. The owner has to pay for the services. But there are some owner responsibilities that actually go to the construction process itself, and that's what Article 5 deals with. 5.1 is about programming. It says the owner will provide information in a timely manner, including a written program. Now, you know from your other classes what programming is, right? That's the owner's desires and uses for the property. Well, according to the B101, that's got to come from the owner, in fact, in a written format. Now, we know that in practice, especially for informal projects, it often doesn't, because the owner doesn't even know what a program is, much less how to prepare a written one. So in practice, one of the things that architects frequently do is work with an owner to try to help the owner develop a program. But the B101 scheme, the AIA, assumes, because these are also for commercial projects, that the owner will develop the program and give it to you. You'll remember that in Article 4, doing programming was an additional service. So under this scheme, if an owner has you do programming, that you're supposed to be charging extra for it. Or if not, you should have worked the time to do the programming into your fee for basic services. There is nothing wrong with you deciding that a service that the AIA lists as additional should in fact be basic and covered under your base fee. That's okay. You just need to plan for it. You need to make sure your base fee is high enough to cover it, and then you need to modify this kind of form so that where it says programming, for example, you scratch that out of additional services and write it into basic services. Very easy to do. But this is the base assumption that the AIA has. In 5.2, we deal with cost. It says the owner will establish and update a budget for the project, including reasonable contingencies. Well, that's obviously important, and you can't be the person to establish the budget because that's personal to the owner, whether it's a business or an individual. You notice that the budget may get updated. Often it changes from one point in time to the other, and the owner's got to tell you about that updating. Contingencies are an important concept to teach your client. A contingency is kind of like a safety fund, so that if the owner has $1 million to spend, the wise thing to do is to plan for a construction project that's going to cost, say, $950,000 or $960,000 and leave the other $40,000 or $50,000 as a contingency, because it's almost universally true that things arise that you don't expect. There are always surprises on a construction project, and if the owner's planning to spend his entire budget on the project itself, when the surprises arise, he won't have any money or source of funds to handle the surprise. So part of what you want to do is to teach the client about the contingencies that could possibly arise. One of them involves architectural services. Often, you will omit something from your drawings that isn't essential, but that the owner ultimately desires that he or she wants. It may be some fancy fixture in a house, or it could be some upgraded material, or whatever it might be. Often, the owner hasn't thought it through thoroughly, or even if he does, may have changed his mind. In those situations, you want the owner to have a contingency so that the owner can upgrade his own project by including whatever element you didn't put on the drawings that he now has decided he wanted. If he doesn't have any money with which to do that, then he's going to be very unhappy and probably going to blame you for not making it possible for him to have what he now wants. Even if that's not fair, I can't tell you how frequently that happens. 5.3 is an agency concept. It says that the owner shall identify a representative, that's an agency concept, authorized, that's real authority, actual authority, to act on the owner's behalf. Now that's obvious if you have a residential situation, your client's going to act for himself. But you often will be dealing with a company, which may have a president and other officers. It may be that you need to have somebody designated to speak on behalf of the company and to make decisions. If you're dealing with a public body, that's really important because there are all kinds of limitations of authorities in public bodies, and you need to have a clear understanding who speaks for the public body. I'm doing a project now for Rush University Medical Center, just a little ways west of here. That's a hospital, and hospitals are famous for having diverse lines of authority. When an architect does a hospital renovation project, the architect usually starts by interviewing the various end users of the project, interviewing the doctors, the nurses, the administrative staff, the orderlies, to get a sense of what they need and what will make their lives easier. And you can bet that every single one of these groups asks for a whole bunch of things that are ultra deluxe that they'd be happy to have that may not fit into the budget. Architects go wrong when they try to please everybody because that usually builds the costs way up beyond what's affordable. So there may be difficult decisions that have to be made to balance the doctor's request versus the administrator's request. You don't want to get caught in the middle of that, because whoever you choose, you're going to have other people be unhappy and blaming you. The better solution is to make sure that the owner has a decision maker appointed, and to take any such conflicts or issues to the decision maker so that it's the client making the decisions that are especially the tough ones, not you. Five.4 starts to talk about information for the project itself. Here you'll see it says that the owner shall furnish surveys to describe essentially the real estate. Surveys come from the owner. The owner owns the real estate. Literally, only the owner can authorize a survey. Remember that there's another clause that we talked about Monday, which says that you have the right to rely on the accuracy and completeness of information provided by the owner's consultants. Well, the surveyor here is one of those owner's consultants. So when you combine these two provisions, it says that you can rely on that survey. If there's a mistake on the survey that you happen to incorporate into your drawings, it's not your fault because you relied on the survey. Now, obviously, if you know of a mistake in the survey, which is pretty rare, you have to bring it to somebody's attention, because this is kind of a no sandbagging rule. But that usually doesn't happen because most architects don't do the kind of detailed investigation that a surveyor does. So the owner provides the survey. You'll see in 5.5 that if you need tests from geotechnical engineers or other things about the soil, that also is provided by the owner who hires these consultants. Now, often an owner will ask you to hire the consultant and promise to reimburse you for the cost. That's not illegal, it's not wrong, but from your standpoint, it's not wise. That's because if you hire the consultant, you become responsible for the consultant's work product, just as you would for your own structural engineers. Now, you may have a claim against the consultant to pass down, but suppose that surveyor made a mistake. And suppose the pipe is in the wrong place because you just copied it from the survey. If the owner blames you for it, you have no excuse if the surveyor was hired by you. Because whether it's your mistake or whether it's your sub-consulting engineer's mistake, it's on your shoulders. You may be able to make a claim against the surveyor, but that's not going to make the owner any happier with you. So you are safer if you don't hire the consultants. If you do hire the consultants, I find that architects constantly make the mistake of just passing through the costs. So let's say the surveyor charges $1,000 for the survey. The architect will get a bill for $1,000, will pass it on to the owner for payment, and then the architect will pay the surveyor. But he doesn't mark it up. Think back to, are any of you familiar with construction projects where the general contractor passes through invoices from subcontractors? The general contractor always marks up those invoices. If the subcontractor's work was $1,000, the general contractor will charge $1,000 plus 15% for the general contractor's overhead and profit. And that's to cover two different things. The general contractor's time and costs in retaining the subcontractor, and the general contractor's risk in case something goes wrong or there's a claim arising out of the subcontractor's work. You have the exact same issues facing you. So in general, it's not a wise idea to hire consultants that would normally be the owners, at least without marking up their fees sufficiently to cover the risks that you incur. And a typical markup would be in the 10% range, more or less. That's just what the market typically allows. What actually happens is that you talk the owner out of making you hire the surveyor. The owner wants you to hire the surveyor so he's under your umbrella. And you say, well, I can do that, but I've got to mark up his invoice 10% to cover overhead and profit and risk. And the owner says, well, I don't want to pay $1,100 when I could be paying $1,000. And your answer is, well, then you hire him. I'll work with him, but you hire him. And then there's no markup necessary. And cheap owners usually go for that. Good question. If you've recommended a consultant to the owner, and then the owner hires that consultant directly, do you bear any responsibility for the consultant's work? The short answer to that is no, you don't. It's the lines of contract that determine liability. If the owner contracted with the consultant, then it's the owner's problem with that consultant, not yours. The only exception to that would be if your recommendation was negligent, if you recommended somebody who really wasn't qualified, or somebody you didn't know well enough or hadn't checked out, then the owner could perhaps claim that you breached your duty of care by not paying enough attention to your recommendations. But in general, you follow the lines of contract for liability with subconsultants or subcontractors. Now, 5.6 is a clause I had you look at last Monday because it's kind of inconsistent with the architect's general obligation to coordinate all of the various parties' consultants. Here it says the owner will coordinate the services of its own consultants with those provided by you. Now that's probably something where you'd have a court having a difficult time interpreting the contract. Last week we talked about interpretation of contracts. What do you think a court would do when we have a clause one that says the architect shall coordinate its work with the owner's consultants? And clause 2 in the same contract, the same document, says that the owner will coordinate the architect's work with the owner's consultants. Sounds like a direct contradiction, right? I don't think so. I think a court would try to give meaning to both clauses. And probably a court would say that it is a joint responsibility of the architect and the owner to coordinate the architect's and consultant's work. Neither clause... If one clause said it's the architect's responsibility and the other one says it's not the architect's responsibility, then you got a conflict. But here you have it being party one's responsibility and later party two's responsibility. So probably the way to reconcile those clauses, a court would say it's both of their responsibilities. Now this clause goes on to say, 5.6, that the owner will provide you with a lot of information about his contract with his consultants, so that you understand where the various scopes and services are. Sorry about that. He'll furnish a copy of the scope of services, so you know exactly what that consultant's been hired to do. And when you request, the owner will provide copies even of the professional liability insurance that the consultants maintain, so that you can verify that they are properly insured for the scope of work that they're doing, so that you don't have any concern about relying on them. Drop down to, as you see, 5.7 is more things that an owner furnishes, like tests, inspections, and reports that the project requires. 5.8 is if the project needs legal or insurance or accounting type work for some reason. That's something that's coming from the owner, not from you, except your pay applications reviews. And 5.9 now is another no sandbagging provision. It says that the owner shall provide prompt written notice to you if the owner becomes aware of a problem, including a problem with your work or a problem with the contractors. It doesn't say that the owner has an obligation to search and find every such problem, but if the owner becomes aware of it, he has to give you written notice of it. Yes, emails are written notices, faxes are written notices. Essentially, modern digital communication counts as a written document. 5.10 is a communications paragraph. It's important for you to know what all the key communications are on the project. So it says that the owner will try to funnel communications to other parties through you. But sometimes, even if the owner speaks directly to the contractor, the owner will keep you informed of whatever key communications occur between the two of them. That's to make sure that you aren't left out in the dark, not knowing some directive that the owner has given to the contractor. Those are essentially the owner's responsibilities. Not very much. Paying and then providing information. And that's pretty much all an owner is obligated to do under the AIA approach. The AIA doesn't assume, at least in this contract form, that you have an owner who is particularly knowledgeable about the construction process. Article 6 addresses a term, kind of a term of art, that's called the cost of the work. And it's kind of defined in 6.1 as being the cost to construct everything, essentially the construction cost. And this term is in here and defined very carefully because there are lots of potential claims and problems that arise when the bids come in too high. Let me back up for a second. There's a story you probably ought to hear regarding 5.11. I really skipped over that a little bit too quickly. 5.11 calls for the owner to coordinate the architect's duties in the construction contract with the architect's duties in this B101 contract. In other words, to avoid assigning the architect more to do in the construction contract than he's actually hiring the architect to do in this contract. Now you might think, how stupid. Who would ever do something like that? But it happens more often than you'd think. The contractor and owner negotiate the construction contract. And the contractor says, I want you to have the architect do X, Y, and Z in addition to what's written here. And the owner figures, it's not coming out of my pocket. I'll write in X, Y, and Z for the architect in the construction contract. Now, we saw Monday that that's not binding on you. It's not in your contract. It's in the construction contract. So you're not bound to do those things unless the owner's talked about it with you and you've explicitly approved. But horrible things can happen when the owner gets screwed up about coordination. There's a famous project in Chicago. I'm not going to mention the name of the developer or the name of the building, but you would recognize it. where the developer did exactly this. Developer hired an architectural firm. It was a high-rise residential building under a normal AIA-style contract. The contract was signed and all that. The drawings and specs were prepared. The developer negotiated a construction contract with the contractor who did just what I was warning about, who asked for the architect to, I take that back, who, this is worse than I had thought. As I recall, the construction contract was also an AIA document and had many of the same services that the owner had hired the architect to do. But the developer got cheap. The developer went back after that and took some things out of your contract, took out site visits, for example, took out pay request review and certification, because he was cheap. He thought, I've got people on staff who can do this myself, who can do this themselves, and I'm already paying them a salary. Why pay the architect hourly to do the same thing? So essentially, you started with two AIA documents where the terms and conditions for the architecture were identical. But then he went back to the architect's contract and removed some of the things, but didn't do the same thing for the construction contract. So the contractor thought that the architect was closely involved. One of the things that got removed from the architect's contract was being the decision maker. Remember we talked about that Monday? The architect is the judge of disputes between the contractor and the owner, and at least the initial judge. And that got taken out of the architect's contract. So when disputes developed on the project, the contractor submitted them to the architect for decision, because the construction contract with the original AIA language still showed that the architect was the initial decision maker. And the architect didn't act on it because the architect's contract had those services taken out. So it wasn't within the architect's scope of work. And the contractor ended up suing the owner for having screwed up the process and basically deprived him of a contractual remedy. In other words, the owner owed the contractor in the construction contract to have an architect in place to make initial decisions, because presumably you'll make them fairly and on the spot and quickly. And without an architect in place, the decision-making process was biased, because the owner made them, slow and screwed up. So the contractor claimed breach of contract because the owner wasn't providing the architectural services that were spelled out in that contract, and won and got a huge judgment against the owner that basically put the owner out of business. And I'm oversimplifying it, but the project basically tanked until there was refinancing and it was taken over because the owner screwed up the way he had the contract provisions read, leaving out architectural provisions.
So was the contract altered by the developer at the beginning, or did
later? The original contract did have these provisions, but later, to save money because he was cheap, the developer altered. Right. The contractor did not agree, did not even know about the changes. The owner and architect, though, modified an already existing contract, because they're allowed to modify a contract they signed. And the way they modified it was like by giving a deductive change order. They took out some architectural duties, and the architect reduced his fee a little bit. And
the
Not exactly. The reason it's a breach of duty is that the owner had also signed a construction contract with the contractor that said the architect would be the decision maker. And when he took it out of the architect's contract, he's now breaching the construction contract. So that's where the breach came. So sorry to back up like that. First step, the architecture contract was signed, AIA standard. Second step, the construction contract was signed, AIA standard. Third step, shortly after the construction contract was signed, the owner and architect went back and modified their contract to take out some of these duties. Fourth step was problems arose on the job where the contractor wanted the architect to make a decision, but the architect wasn't being paid to do it. So that's how it arose. But these kinds of, you know, owners who aren't that sophisticated and don't pay attention to the need to have identical type contracts fall into this trap with some regularity. Not as bad as this project, but it's not that rare. Question?
Yeah, I was wondering, but I was worried about the project manager.
Who's project manager? One hired by the owner?
Yeah, one.
Well, the owner is generally asked to designate a representative to speak for him. We talked about that about 10 minutes ago. And often what they do is designate the program manager to speak for them. For instance, for Rush University, where I'm handling the construction out there, Rush has hired a joint venture comprised of Power Construction and Jacobs Engineering. They call themselves the Power Jacobs Joint Venture, and they are the program managers for the hospital reconstruction. And they are the owner's representatives, able to speak for the owner with regard to the construction, the owner's agent, to use agency language. So cost of the work, the construction cost. 6.2 is important. It says that the preliminary estimate of the cost of the work, which is something that you prepare, and updated estimates prepared by you, represent your judgment as a design professional, but that neither you nor the owner have control over a lot of factors that go into construction costs, like the cost of labor, materials, or equipment, the methods of determining bid prices, competitive bidding, or negotiation, or marketing conditions. And then it goes on to say, accordingly, the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent, that means does not guarantee, that bids or prices won't vary from budget. So it's kind of a wiggle room clause for you. It's saying that your estimates are your best judgment, and you'll see that what they're based on in a moment or two, but it says you are not guaranteeing that the project will come in on budget. No guarantee, just exercising professional judgment. So can you be liable if the project is over budget? The answer is yes, but not automatically. You're not automatically liable because you're not guaranteeing that it'll meet the budget, but if you were negligent, if you weren't appropriately careful or skillful in your estimating, if you made a mathematics error, for example, then you might be liable for the consequences, and we'll talk about those consequences in a little bit. Six point three explains how you're supposed to put your preliminary cost estimates together. It says that you can include contingencies for price escalation, that you can make reasonable adjustments in the program and scope of the project in order to come in at budget. And it basically says that your estimate is going to be based on current area, volume, or similar conceptual estimating techniques. Now that means it's very broad, very general. That means you're figuring out how many square feet and multiplying by an approximate per square foot cost for this style of construction. That's very different from what a contractor does, at least at the later stages. Contractors do takeoffs. They figure out how many feet of wallboard, of countertop. They price those and multiply them. They're called takeoffs, and that's detailed cost estimating. Detailed cost estimating was an additional service in Article 4 that we went over last Monday. This is conceptual cost estimating, which is at a much more general level of detail, which is fortunate because most of you don't have the ability or the knowledge to do detailed cost estimating. It's quite a difficult skill. 6.5 starts the discussion of what happens if the project is over budget. It says that the architect will make appropriate recommendations to the owner to adjust the project size, quality, or budget. And importantly, it says that the owner shall cooperate with you in making those adjustments. So the owner can't say, I want everything I told you, but I also want it to cost less. You know, that's like a tantrum. That's not possible, or it's not usually possible. So the owner isn't contractually allowed to have his cake and eat it too. He's not allowed to have it both ways, where he gets all the quantity and quality he wants, but without paying the price for it. He has to adjust his budget if he's going to insist on that kind of quantity and quality. And 6.6 is one of the more important provisions. It says, if you bust the budget, if the cost of the work at the end of the CD phase, when you've got buildable drawings ready for building, is above the budget, then these are the alternatives that the owner can select. He can, number one, increase the budget. That's what makes everybody happy, maybe except for him. He can, number two, authorize rebidding or renegotiation. He might have been dealing with a union contractor and decided that's too expensive. He can try a non-union contractor and see if he can get better prices from them. The owner can also decide the project just isn't feasible. It's going to be too expensive and terminate it. End the project right then and there. That's certainly the owner's prerogative. More frequently, he'll do number four, which is in consultation with you, revise the program, scope, or quality to bring down the cost of the work. That's called value engineering. Basically, making adjustments to the drawings, specifications, or other programming criteria to reduce construction costs. And number five, of course, just says that anything else the two of you agree on is okay, too. 6.7 is a very interesting clause that many people don't sufficiently appreciate. It describes what happens when alternative number four is chosen, when the owner chooses to value engineer the project down. It says that you, without additional compensation, have to basically redo the construction documents to value engineer the project down. That is a risk for you. That means you may be putting in uncompensated time to achieve the budget. But there's a trade-off for it. It says then that your modification of the CDs shall be the limit of your responsibility. So you have both a floor and a ceiling. It may cost you to have to value engineer it down without being paid extra. But that's the only claim the owner can make against you for doing the value engineering work. The owner can't make a claim that says, your design was negligent because it was too expensive and I want damages, money damages as a result. The contract simply doesn't allow it. That's why the cost of the work has an article all to itself. It is very easy for it to be a subject of disagreement and claims. It's far too easy for an architect to over-design. If you talk to people not in the architectural profession, they'll tell you that architects are guilty of this all the time, that architects constantly over-design. And there is some truth to that, partly because you're trying to make your client or its representatives happy, trying to give them what they want, and you really are not trained to do any detailed cost estimating as you go along. One of the advantages of things like construction or program management or having a negotiated contractor on board at an early stage is that the contractor can be giving you real-time cost information about where you are with the drawings so that the contractor can be pricing it out as you go along. And instead of designing way above the budget and having to value engineer down, hopefully the contractor can be identifying where you're high and you're building up to the budget. So you don't have to willy-nilly cut things out, which is almost always an inefficient and unhappy process.
What happens if the owner goes over budget and there is like a delay for the project, and they're like, if they even took a decision like quick what to do because they're over budget, like how can they actually fight that?
Very good question. Good question. What happens when going over budget delays the project, where the owner may have deadlines to meet, or you may even have contractual deadlines for publishing a final set of construction documents, and you can't do it because you're busy value engineering the overage out of the project right now? Well, that's why 6.7 is such an incredibly important provision. It says that the owner cannot make any other claim against the architect for the project being over budget, except to obligate him to value engineer it down. So the owner is giving up the right to make a delay claim against the architect because of the length of time it's taking to value engineer the project. So this clause is there precisely to avoid an owner being able to make that kind of claim against an architect. This is one of those areas that needs education. When you're working with your unsophisticated clients, you need to talk about cost of the work And you especially need to educate your clients about what you do and what you don't do with regard to costing. Most clients don't understand that architects can't do detailed cost estimates. They think you're the construction professional. If anyone ought to be able to do them, you can. So you need to educate them about how you are merely guesstimating costs. And if the owner wants to know precise costs at any stage, the owner can hire a contractor or cost consultant to give him that information, but it can't come from you. You also want to explain how you as an architect don't know where the bids are going to come in until you're done with the CDs and can distribute them in general, so that the owner isn't shocked to find out that the bids are over his budget, especially if the owner is telling you put X, Y, and Z in, then we'll see where the price comes back. That happens all the time. So education is a critical element of what you need to do here. It doesn't say that. 6.7 says that if the bids come in too high, they're over budget, and the owner decides that the way he wants to proceed is to value engineer the project down and then rebid it, then he can make you value engineer it down without paying you one more cent for it, but that's all he can do. He can't also sue you or arbitrate against you for project delays or for blowing a timetable or leaving things out of the project because they're being value engineered out. He can't have both.
So if there's, like, if after value engineering, some costs go down by design decision change or something, mm-hmm. So you still carry on all the responsibility of the project all along?
Yes, once it's value engineered down and everybody agrees on the new construction documents and the bids come back and the owner agrees to that price, then the project carries on as if this never happened. This is just a blip in the project, and there's no more liability for the architect because you've discharged that liability by value engineering the drawings down. Copyrights and licenses. We're going to talk about this in theory next week. It's not as complicated as you may think. I'm going to give you today what the B101 approach to copyrights of architectural drawings is, and then we'll talk about the alternatives and what the theory and law of it all is next week. 7.1 says that whenever either party, you or the owner, sends a drawing or a document to the other one, you are basically warranting that you are the author of that drawing or that you have the right to send it. So anybody who transmits materials is basically saying, I have the right to do so. I'm not breaching any copyright by sending this to you. That's obviously true for you and your drawings and your engineer's drawings, but it's also true for anything the owner may send you from the owner's own consultants. So you can rely on information you've gotten from the owner, knowing that the owner has the right to reproduce it and have you reproduce it. And similarly, the owner can rely on your drawings being original work from you. If the drawings or whatever are in digital form, which is how they most frequently are today, then it says that you and the owner will establish a protocol, some kind of understanding for how digital transmissions will be treated. Because digital transmissions are a little bit different from paper transmissions. If you transmit a drawing on paper, you have the original of what it was, and if the owner changes it, it's easy to tell. But if you send the owner a digital file, you know, a CAD file or something like that, the owner presumably can load it on his own computer and change things on it, and you may never even know that that's happened. So you generally want to have a set of ground rules, which is what protocols are for digital transmission. The AIA has one. They have a separate document, which is a sample set of protocols for digital work. This isn't such a big deal for you guys. You've grown up in the digital era, and you understand how digital documents work. This is a big concept for architects who are 30 or 40 years older than you, who still like to draw with a pencil and a drafting table. 7.2 says that you and your consultant shall be deemed the authors and owners of their respective drawings and specs, and will retain all the rights. That basically says that the design team owns the copyright. The design team has the ownership interest in the drawings. So what does the owner have? If you have the copyright, how can the owner use it? Well, that's what 7.3 is all about. It says that you give the owner what's called a license, a non-exclusive license to use, and they're called instruments of service here. We'll talk about that next week, but that basically means your drawings and specs for the project. That means a license. You all got driver's licenses, right? It's a card. But a license in law doesn't have to be a card. A license is just a right, a legal right. Your driver's license says you have a legal right to operate a car. A license in this context says that the owner has a legal right to use whatever he's licensed to use, in this case, drawings and specs. So the architect and the design team remain the owner of the drawings and specs. But the owner is given a license, which is a right or permission, to use them solely for the purpose of constructing, essentially, and related things, the project. So basically, the owner is allowed to use the drawings and specs for the project and nothing else. Provided, it says, that the owner substantially performs its obligations, including prompt payment. That means that if the owner sticks you, the owner loses his license to use the drawings. And that's a powerful tool. Architects want that. It's here because the AIA is your trade organization. It says that if the owner doesn't pay you, then the owner loses his license to use the drawings and can't use them anymore. You could literally go to federal court to stop the project if you're not paid, because that would be violation of a copyright, and we'll talk about the remedies available. No, the owner would still have the right, after the project is finished, to use the drawings for things like maintaining, altering, or adding to the project. And that makes sense because the drawings are kind of basically reference information for future use. Well, that's a really good question, and that's explicitly forbidden here. That's why it's only for the project. In fact, one of my very first cases was a house that was built in northern Wisconsin with a flat roof that ended up collapsing because of the load of snow on it. And the architect's defense, because the roof was definitely not structurally sufficient to withstand the snow load, the architect's defense was, when he designed it for the client was planning on building it in Arizona, where they were retiring. And they ended up taking the same drawings, hiring a local Wisconsin architect to stamp them, and building it in Wisconsin. Well, there's not much snow load in Arizona. So it was a pretty easy defense, and we ended up settling the case very, very cheaply. But that's because the owner tried to use the drawings for a different project, and that's not allowed. Notice that the license is non-exclusive. That means that if you loved your design, you can reuse it or major portions of it for somebody else, another client. It doesn't mean it's a one-off. It means that you have the right to use the drawings too. If the owner had an exclusive license, that means only the owner can use it. And it's not in your interest to make the license exclusive. Notice that if the owner breaches the contract, question?
Yes, so you're using the same drawing, but doesn't the architect have to get approval from the owner before to use the exact same drawing or concept for another client?
No, the answer is no, because the architect in this clause is retaining the right to use the documents. Just because the owner does have a right to use it, doesn't mean he has the right to forbid anybody else from using it. So you could, legally if you wanted to, take the same set of drawings, make minor alterations to fit some other site, and then turn them over to another client to build the almost identical house. Perfectly legally under this clause.
So
Well, it's not clear that you have the right to hire somebody else for design development to build, to add on to the first architect's schematic design, because the first architect that you hire, if it's under this contract, owns the copyright to his drawings. If another architect takes them and adds more detail to them, but keeps them essentially the same underneath, that's arguably violating the first architect's copyright. To do something like that, you would have to make arrangements with the first architect to have that right. It's not hard to do, it's not even unfair, but you need to think ahead and make sure you give yourself the right to do that. So if the owner breaches the contract, where does it say this? Oh, you paginate it a little differently than I am. It says at the end, if the architect rightfully terminates this agreement for cause, that means if the owner breaches the contract and you take your remedy of terminating the contract for cause, meaning for breach, then the owner loses the license that you gave him in this paragraph, which is just another way of saying if he doesn't pay you or otherwise breaches the contract, he loses the right to use your drawings. It's a good question. We're going to deal with this more next week, but the general rule is that copyright infringements are questions of fact. It is a fact question whether drawing B is similar enough to drawing A to constitute a copyright infringement. That'll depend on lots of factors. I can't give you a general rule because you can understand why no general rule works when you compare two drawings of different things. But generally what a court will do is look at all the features of exhibit of drawing A, look at all the comparable features of exhibit B, then all the different features of exhibit B, and make a judgment as to whether it's different enough so that it's not a copyright infringement. 731 makes it clear that you need to be employed on the project. It says if the owner uses the drawings and specs without retaining their offer, which is you, then the owner is releasing you and your consultants from all claims that he might have and is agreeing to indemnify you, we'll talk about indemnity in a future class, from any consequences. Essentially that means that if the owner is going to hire you just to do drawings and specs and then use them on his own without your continued involvement in the project, all risks are on the owner, not on you. And that's because, as we all know, there are lots of details and issues that are too small to find their way into the drawings and specs, that are handled in the shop drawing process or the RFI process, that tell the contractor how to build. And you need to be involved in the project on an ongoing basis to fill in those gaps in your CDs, and if you're not, then it's the owner's risk himself. That's a good question, too. How often should an architect perform periodic site visits during construction? Well, the answer is it depends. It depends on the nature of the project. Is it simple or is it complex? It depends on the owner's own staff. At Rush, you know, the owner has a huge staff of Power Jacobs people who are inspecting the site on a regular basis, so the architect doesn't have to be there very often at all. It also depends on the timing of the construction. There are certain construction activities which are very important for you to observe, like pouring concrete over rebar to make sure that the rebar is in place. And there are others that you don't need to be there to observe because you can check them out when you're there 2 weeks later. They won't be covered up. So there's no one right answer to your question. It depends on a lot of judgment factors that I hope you'll all develop as you get more experienced in your careers. Now we move on to Article 8, which is all about claims and disputes. There are a bunch of specialized provisions here. The first one, 8.1.1, is like a statute of limitations, except it's not a statute. It's a limitations clause in the contract. It basically says that you can't bring claims after a certain length of time. And that length of time here is 10 years from substantial completion of the work. It says this doesn't invalidate the applicable laws. So if there's a shorter statute of limitations in law that applies, that continues to apply. But if there isn't one, some states don't have one. Indiana's is 20 years, I think. Then the 10-year period in the contract is the cutoff time for making a claim. 8.1.2 is an interesting concept called a waiver of subrogation. Subrogation. It's an insurance concept. It means that when an insurance company pays off on a loss, it then has the right to step into the shoes of its client and sue the responsible parties to get the money back. I had a case up in the northern suburbs in Lake Bluff where during excavation on a project on an open site, they undercut the wall of the building that was immediately adjacent, and that building wall collapsed and put the retail places there out of business temporarily. There's a lot of loss involved. Fortunately, the building was insured, and they paid to have the wall rebuilt and the retailers made whole and all that. So everything was fine, except that the insurance company, who paid off everybody, then turned around and filed a lawsuit against the general contractor, the excavator, and even my client, the architect, for not having stopped the undercutting. And they're trying to recover their losses from the parties who were actually responsible. This provision says, can't do that. If there's a property insurer for the project, it's usually the owner's property insurer. The parties agree that that this right of subrogation is waived, that the insurance company isn't allowed to sue anybody to collect its losses back, that the losses stay with the insurance company. And that's pretty much what 8.1.2 says. No, because an insurance company can never sue its own insured party. You know, your auto insurance policy, if you're in an accident and the insurance company pays off, they can't then try to get the money they paid back from you. You pay premiums to them so that they won't do that. So an insurance company can't try to recover money from its own insureds, but the architect isn't an insured under the property policy. So this makes sure that they can't try to recover it from the architect either. Yeah, they recovered. Yes, and the insurance company did recover a lot of money from the general contractor. We were able to show that we weren't on the site when it happened. We didn't have an obligation to be on the site. So we settled that case very cheaply for the architect. But both the excavation contractor and the general contractor ended up paying a lot of money. That's a good question too. Settling lawsuits. Remember I told you how expensive it is to fight and win a lawsuit? I mean, tens of thousands of dollars at a minimum. So often, the smarter thing to do, if you can prove that you weren't responsible, isn't to go to trial and win, because that ends up costing you $30,000, $50,000, $70,000. The smarter thing to do is to make a deal with the plaintiff that says, listen, you know you're going to lose and I'm going to win. Instead of each of us paying $75,000 to get to that result, what if we give you $10,000 now? And you drop your case against us. So settling cheaply is like giving in to legal blackmail. It says, I know you can force me to spend $70,000 to win this case. I'd rather pay a fraction of that to you now, not to have to fight it anymore. And that's the best bottom line result that I can often get from my clients. It's unfortunate, but in the real world, that's usually the best you can go for. 8.1.3 has a term that you should find familiar. The architect and owner waive consequential damages against each other. Do you remember consequential damages from last week? We were talking about the factory that couldn't manufacture widgets because there was a construction defect. Well, those remote damages are called consequential damages. Not the direct damages for fixing the defect, but the remote ones for losing market share because the factory is slower to get into production. Those kinds of remote damages are waived. And you can do that in a contract. You can say both sides agree not to collect this category of damages from the other. Or you could say the reverse. Both sides agree that it is collectible. It's a matter of agreement. Now, in practicality, this is one of those clauses where the AIA is being sneaky in your favor. Because you don't really have consequential damages. You know, when an architect when the owner breaches the contract with the architect, it's almost always the consequence that you aren't being paid. That's almost always how a breach occurs to you. And suing to collect what you're owed is a direct damage. It's not a consequential damage. They stiff you $50,000, you sue to collect the $50,000. Direct damages. But owners can have consequential damages. If your design problem is what put this widget factory down for a period of time, so they ended up losing market share, the owner's damages, consequential damages, may be immense. So by both parties waiving, giving up consequential damages, you're giving up something you don't really have. But the owner's giving up something substantial. But it looks totally mutual. So this is an example of the AIA drafting something in a way that's very favorable for you, but covering it up to make it look kind of mutual or fair. 8.2, the whole section 8.2, is about mediation. It's a mandatory mediation clause. Remember mediation from the first class? Mediation is the non-binding kind of dispute resolution where you have a formal negotiation session that is facilitated by a third-party neutral who tries to persuade each party to compromise appropriately. The AIA documents all favor mediation, and that means that any dispute has to go to mediation before it can go to anything else. And what is the anything else it goes to? Well, that's 8.2.4. Sure. Yes.
So basically any time you disagree with the owner, you have to go to mediation?
Well, any time the disagreement is serious enough that you would otherwise sue him in court or he would sue you or go to binding arbitration, this says you have to do mediation first. If you can solve a problem before getting to that stage, then obviously you don't need to mediate it. But by being a condition precedent, it means no lawsuit without mediating first. Now, is there going to be a lawsuit or is there going to be an arbitration? Remember, arbitration is the binding kind of alternative dispute resolution that we talked about with an expert panel of arbitrators. Well, it depends on what box is checked up here. In the actual form, you have the right to check whichever box. And it's either usually the top one, which is arbitration, or the middle one, which is litigation. Something sneaky that you should know. In the AIA software, when you print out a blank contract, it comes with the arbitration box pre-checked. At least it always has. I can't tell you if their most recent iteration of software has fixed that, but there's a bias in favor of arbitration because that box starts out with the check mark or with the X in it. Now, you can take it out easily when you're preparing the contract, but you have to affirmatively take it out or else it shows up there. All the prior versions of the AIA documents, the 1997 version, the 87 version, the earlier versions, all had mandatory arbitration. Litigation in court wasn't even an option. But the AIA has seen a history of results in arbitration that they're not so happy with. So they no longer are willing to say all architect disputes must be resolved in arbitration. They're willing to let the parties make their choice. Now, if you check the top box, arbitration, then section 8.3 comes into play. 8.3 sets out the rules for arbitration, binding arbitration. It talks about the American Arbitration Association administering it. We talked about this in the very first class. It also talks about joinder or consolidation in 8.3.4. That's because one of the weaknesses of arbitration has always been that it's hard to get all of the parties into the same arbitration hearing. Arbitration is a function of contract. So if A has a contract with B that has an arbitration clause, they'll go to arbitration. But if B has a contract with C that doesn't have an arbitration clause, they can't go to arbitration because they haven't agreed. And often, there has been, in the past, there have been provisions that say the architect has the right to arbitrate its claims with the owner separate and apart from any other of the arbitrations that the owner is involved in. So the owner has a construction contract with an arbitration clause and a design contract with an arbitration clause. It used to be in the past that he couldn't combine all three parties into the same forum. Here it says you can. One of the complaints about arbitration was the inability to do this joinder or consolidation. Now in the new 2007 document, it says that these arbitrations can be consolidated. So you can get all of the parties with similar arbitration clauses into the same hearing. Oops. Article 9, termination or suspension. There are two different ways to terminate a project. One is for cause, and the other is for convenience. Cause means the other party breached the contract. Convenience means nobody breached the contract, but one party or the other doesn't want to continue any longer. As a general rule, owners can terminate for either reason. If the architect breaches the contract and defaults, the owner can terminate for cause. But even if you've done nothing whatsoever that's wrong, the owner can still terminate the contract because it's his project. He can decide that he's had a financial reversal and can't go through with it. And there are different consequences depending on whether you're being terminated because you did something wrong or terminated for reasons that aren't your fault. An architect, on the other hand, doesn't really have two options, only has one option for terminating the contract. You don't have the right to terminate for convenience. You're not allowed to walk out of the project in the middle and leave the owner high and dry. You know, a surgeon can't leave the surgery in the middle just because he calls it off. An architect only has the right to terminate for cause, and that's usually not being paid. In fact, you have a lesser included right, too. You don't have to terminate, which means end forever, the contract. You can suspend it, which means that you are basically putting it in hiatus, not performing anymore until you get paid. And that's what these provisions in this article are all about. So 9.1 says, if the owner fails to make proper payments for you, that failure shall be considered substantial non-performance, that means breach, and cause for termination or, at your option, suspension of performance. So that's explaining that non-payment justifies you terminating or suspending for cause. Now, the owner can suspend a project, but the owner, of course, suspends it for convenience, like the bank hasn't opened his loan yet, so he can't do anything more. If the owner suspends the project, here in 9.2, it says you'll be compensated for the services you've performed up until the suspension, and then when the project resumes, you'll be compensated again for your services, plus your fees or schedule will be adjusted to account for any inefficiencies that you suffer because of the suspension. It's only fair, but it's in here, of course, because this is an AIA document looking out for its architects. 9.3 says that if the owner suspends for more than 90 days, that's too long, then you have the right to actually terminate the contract. You don't have to put up with suspensions that are that long. 9.4 is the generic termination for cause provision. It says that either party can terminate the contract by giving 7 days advance written notice if the other party fails substantially to perform, which means breaches the contract. Why do you think you have to give 7 days written notice? Or why does the owner have to give the same kind of notice? Well, it's to give you an opportunity, give the innocent, I'm sorry, the breaching party an opportunity to cure the default. Instead of throwing out the whole contract because the owner's a day late with payment, you're supposed to send a letter or an email to the owner that says, pursuant to 9.4, you're in default of your payment obligations, and I'll terminate the contract in 7 days unless you've paid me by then. And that gives the owner a chance to make good. I mean, sometimes payments really do get held up in the mail, although that's not usually the case. 9.5 is the convenience termination we talked about, that the owner can terminate the agreement with notice, 7 days notice to you for his convenience and without cause. And the 7 days notice is less important in this case. It's not because there's anything you need to cure. It's to give you a chance to wind down your activities in a natural manner rather than releasing people right there on the spot. You can reassign them and get reorganized because of the 7 days. But this is a convenience termination. 9.6 explains that if you've been terminated and it's not your fault, it's a convenience termination, the owner has to pay you for all the services you've performed and reimbursable expenses plus termination expenses, which are basically usually defined as out-of-pocket expenses that you've incurred because of a premature termination. More like restocking charges or something like that, or having to pay off a subconsultant. Notice that there's another very favorable provision for you here. It says that your termination expenses, if you're terminated for convenience, include an amount for your profit on the value of the services not performed. So if you were expecting to earn, say, 5% profit on the job, you can bill as termination expenses 5% of the services that you haven't yet performed, kind of the lost profits that you're not going to get if this is terminated prematurely. That's very favorable for you. Almost all owners that I know take that provision out of this contract. It's more standard in the industry than not to take it out of the contract because it's such a one-sided provision in your favor. Section 10, Article 10, miscellaneous provisions. I want to highlight some of the concepts we've talked about. If you look at 10.3, it says that neither you nor the owner can assign the agreement without the other's written consent. Remember assignment of contracts? This says that you can't assign it to another architect and the owner can't assign it to another company or division. Except that there's a special exception for the owner assigning the agreement to a lender who's providing financing. That's because a construction lender will only lend money based on what's called a conditional assignment of your contract. Here's how it works. The borrower, who's the owner, signs a document with the bank that says, if I default on my construction loan and you take over the project, then this document arranges for my contract with the architects to be assigned to you. And you basically approve that document, approving the assignment. So now the developer goes bankrupt, which has happened more often than I care to think about these last couple of years. The bank steps in and takes over the project because it has the mortgage on the land. And it's got a hole in the ground. That's where things are right now. Chicago Spire is a good example. I'm afraid I'm guilty. I'm the guy who closed that project down by filing the first mechanics lien for the architect. But the bank basically is taking over the project subject to the various contractors' liens. And Now, this project, they're not going to finish because it would be incredibly expensive and probably no market for it anyway. But in a more normal project, the bank would think, I can't do anything with a land that's got a hole in it and nothing else. I can't even sell it to make my loan back. What I need to do is to finish the project the way it was designed, pretending that I'm now the developer, and then hopefully I can flip it and sell it to somebody else for enough of a profit to make my loan proceeds back. But the only way the bank can make you continue working on the project as the architect and make the construction contractor do it too is to get an assignment of their claim, of their contract. So for the Spire and for almost every project where there's a construction loan, the bank has the right to step into the developer's shoes and make you as the architect and the contractor as the constructor finish the project. Otherwise, you could say, I'm not going to work for you, Mr. Bank. I don't have a contract with you. You can't make me do anything at all. And you'd be right. But you, by consenting to this particular assignment, you're saying you'll treat the lender as if it were the developer if the developer's defaulted off the project. 10.4, executing certificates. There are a lot of different certificates that lenders and sometimes municipalities and other third parties may require the architect to sign to attest to some portion of the project. Lenders will often force you to sign something that says, the work's being done in accordance with the drawings and specifications. Adequate utilities exist at the property line. A whole bunch of other things, some of which you can know to be true and some of which you can't. The reason that this provision requires the owner to give you these certificates at least 2 weeks in advance of when you're obligated to sign them is so you can check over the language. My clients send these to me all the time and say, ask me, is it safe to sign it? And I read it, and I'm basically doing one thing. I'm checking the language to see if the architect would have first-hand knowledge of whether it's true or not. So if the language says, I, the architect, hereby certify that my drawings and specifications were prepared in accordance with all applicable laws, codes, regulations, etc., well, that's okay. That's your own drawings. You know firsthand that they comply with code, at least presumably should. So you can certify to that. But it will go on to say, I, the architect, also certify that the construction work that has been done to date on the site is in accordance with my drawings and specifications. Well, you don't know that for sure. You didn't see all of the construction work. You were just there periodically. It might be true, but you don't know it firsthand. So I modify that language in these certificates by adding this knowledge, information, and belief language that we talked about Monday. So I change this certificate so it will say, I, the architect, hereby certify that to the best of my knowledge, information, and belief, the construction work is in accordance with the drawings and specifications. That you do have firsthand knowledge of. That's just saying, I know my state of mind, and I'm not aware of any defects. If you are aware, you can't say that at all. You have to list the defects. But presumably you don't know of any defects, and then you can say, to the best of my belief, there aren't any, because that's true. So you need to get these certificates in advance and to verify that the language is something that you can sign. Sometimes there's something on the certificate that's totally out of the scope of your work. It might say that the property is in compliance with all applicable environmental laws, codes, and regulations. Well, you may have no idea. You didn't do the environmental site assessment. The owner's other consultant did that. Well, we have to take that out totally from this certificate and let the bank put it in a different certificate that the environmental consultant will sign. So it's important to review these documents and to have a long enough lead time so that you can. The last sentence saves you by saying that you're not required to sign a certificate that would require knowledge, services, or responsibilities outside your scope of services. 10.5. Nothing in this agreement shall create a contractual relationship with or a cause of action in favor of a third party against either the owner or architect, What contract concepts does that call to mind? Third-party beneficiary. Remember that two people can enter into a contract that's for the benefit of a third party, like a developer hiring you to design a house for his aging mother. Then the mother is a third-party beneficiary, typically. This clause says, in this contract, there are no third-party beneficiaries. The only people who can enforce this contract are the owner and the architect. Even if the work happens to benefit some third party, that's just incidental, and they're not intended to be a third-party beneficiary. 10.6 is here because environmental laws have gotten to be so ridiculously expensive and punitive. It says that you just don't have any responsibility for anything having to do with hazardous materials or toxic substances. It's probably a little bit overbroad. It probably should refer to pre-existing toxic materials or hazardous substances, because you might be responsible for them if you were specifying them. If you were specifying something that was made out of or contained mercury, which is a toxic substance, you're responsible if it's inappropriately designed for the project. But generally, you're not designing by using toxic materials, so this doesn't become a problem. Is an important paragraph for your business purposes. It says that you'll have the right at the end of the project to photograph it and to make use of those photographs for promotional purposes, that the owner is giving you permission in advance, and that if the owner produces promotional materials for the project, you know, it's a rental apartment building and he makes pamphlets. The last sentence says that that he will give you provide professional credit for you as the architect in these promotional materials. Now, this isn't critical legally for the project, but it's important to you from a business standpoint, because your best source of future work is people who have liked your other work. And it's important to become known and identified with the actual projects that you do. 10.8 concerns confidential material. I told you before that often when you're dealing with, I think we were talking about injunctions a week ago, and a court injunction is a court order that can bar you from sharing proprietary or confidential materials. This is the provision in the B101 that deals with that, 10.8. It says that you will keep such information strictly confidential and not disclose it except to your employees, those who need to know, or your consultants and contractors who have similar restrictions. So basically it says you'll only disclose it as needed to perform your services. But they've left something out. What happens if you're served with a subpoena by somebody who's going to force you to testify about this information or to produce the documents? You need to build an extra exception into 10.8 for process of law, because a court can make you reveal confidential information even if you have a contract that says you're not allowed to. I'm going to take you through Article 11 kind of quickly because it's mostly blanks. I just want to show you how it works. Article 11 is about compensation. In 11.1, you put down your fee for basic services. Now, it could be defined a lot of different ways. You could define it as a lump sum, $10,000. You could define it as an hourly rate, based on $75 an hour, with or without a cap. You could define it as a percentage of construction. Could be 10% of the cost of the work, which is why that term is defined earlier on. Cost of the work is the construction cost. Often architects charge that way. There's no right or wrong, and in fact, in 2 weeks, former professor John Maxey is going to be here to talk to you about how to charge for your work and whether to do it as a percentage or a lump sum or whatever. He's going to give 2 guest lectures, and we'll cover that topic from the point of view of an architect who ran a darn good business. 11.2 is how you bill for additional services. Now, you can't quote a lump sum here because you don't know whether there will be any or how many. So additional services in 11.2 are almost always done as some kind of hourly rate. Um, 11.3 is another additional services provision. 4.1, if you remember, under 11.2 is the optional additional services, the ones that an owner can choose or not. 4.3 are the contingent additional services, the ones that may simply arise during the project and no one can predict it in advance. But usually you have the same hourly rate in both sections. 11.4 is passing through how your consultants will be compensated for additional services. 11.5 is an interesting breakdown. It breaks down the project into its five phases, and it gives you a chance to identify what percentage of your fee will be paid in each phase. I'm going to write down what the most typical, or not write down, I'm going to tell you what the most typical percentages are. You probably want to write them down, but I think Professor Maxey will cover this too. Schematic design phase is usually 15% of your fee. Design development is usually 20% of your fee. Construction documents are usually 40% of your fee. Now we're up to 75 rather. Bidding and negotiation is usually 5% of your fee. And the remaining 20% is usually the construction phase. It's not always the case. There's no legal requirement that you adhere to that breakdown, but experience has shown that for most projects, that's the percentage breakdown for where you spend your fees. 11.6 is a paragraph that talks about how you get compensated if the project is never built. What happens if you're billing, you've agreed your fee is going to be 10% of the cost of construction, and it's never built? Well, 11.6 says that then you'd use the most recent estimate of the cost of the work. So your kind of fee is evolving as it goes along. During the design phases, it's based on an estimate, or as the estimate gets refined. Once construction bids have been received, then it's based on the lowest acceptable bid. It's your estimate of the probable construction cost that the other, you weren't here on Monday, were you? We talked about on Monday. Each of the different phases of design requires you to provide a construction cost estimate to the owner. And that's what the fee is based on. Reimbursable expenses in 11.8. In addition to billing your fees, there are certain out-of-pocket type expenses that are typically reimbursed by your client over and above your fees. This changes and it's subject to negotiation. Transportation and travel is usually reimbursable, although sometimes not within the same city, only if there's longer travel involved. Long distance services for teleconferences or project websites. It used to be that there were long distance charges until there were cell phones. Now there aren't any, at least for cell phone talk. So some of this is a little bit obsolete. Fees paid to public authorities that are permitting the project. Printing, reproduction, postage, handling, and delivery, all of these are standard reimbursable expenses. Overtime work, if it's done with the owner's approval. Renderings, models, mock-ups, professional photography, those are all optional, but the cost, if you have to hire somebody to do that, is a pass-through cost as a reimbursable expense. If the owner tries to make you buy more professional liability insurance than you already cover, the extra premiums are a reimbursable expense. Illinois doesn't levy taxes on professional services, so this doesn't apply. Site office expenses, if you have, actually it's a big enough project to set up a site on the office, the cost of renting the trailer or whatever it might be is a reimbursable expense. These are subject to negotiation, they're subject to change. It used to be that the cost of computer time for computer functions was a reimbursable expense. But that's obsolete now because everybody's doing work on PCs or on private servers, and you don't have to pay for the usage of somebody's computer time. You're probably too young to remember when that was more common. Reimbursable expenses are often marked up. It is typical for an architect to be able to collect 110% of the out-of-pocket expenses that they spend to cover the administrative time that's spent in procuring and handling the invoices and passing it through and the time value of the money and all of that. That's a function for negotiation. I have seen multiples as high as 25% here, but I've also seen a lot of them pass through at cost with no markup. So it's purely a function of negotiation in 11.8.2. 11.9 is a brand new provision in this document. It didn't exist in prior versions of the document. And it is because some of the high-profile designers found that they were getting screwed by developers. I represent a number of them here in Chicago, and they were all telling the same story, that they would get hired to do, under a traditional architectural contract, to do typical architectural services, and they would start by doing schematic design and beginning the design development when the client would terminate the contract, terminating it for convenience and would pay for it so that the client retained the right to use, it was drafted, so that the client retained the right to use the designs. And then the client would go to some cheap architect who isn't an upper niche designer with lower fees and would hire them to finish the documents, to finish the DD phase and do construction documents. And then the client would get the benefit of a superior design without the superior designer's firm having the opportunity to earn the fee from the construction documents phase. Well, in order to avoid that problem, which appeared to be common, the AIA added 11.9, which says that when this happens, the owner needs to pay a licensing fee as compensation for the owner's continued use of the drawings, even if somebody else completes them. So if the top-notch designer gets terminated during design development, they get paid this extra fee, which would presumably compensate them for their lost profits for not getting to finish the project. And that is added recently to this contract. Yes, absolutely. Everything in here is subject to negotiation. You know what I mean by a default position. That's the initial position in a document or an arrangement. B101 should be considered the default position for negotiations. But just like any other default position, the parties can agree to change anything they want. So savvy owners negotiate away a lot of these provisions and protections, while the architects tend to fight for them. So that's the dynamic in negotiating these kinds of contracts.
So
but then we don't have a problem so much, because if the developer fires outstanding architect number one and brings the project to average architect number two and just describes the project but doesn't share outstanding architect's fantastic schematic design work, then architect number two is really designing from scratch. He understands things, but he doesn't have the benefit of the earlier design. Now, if you're able to convey, if your words are so precise that you can describe to architect number two the design features that architect number one put in, then it would be copyright infringement for architect number two to copy the design of architect number one, even if he didn't see it, if it was just described to him. So this license is necessary so that the second architect has the right to reproduce the schematic design that the first architect did and then add to it. Well, in these situations where a developer is developing something like this, The architect doesn't pre-publish anything. I mean, it's all confidential. The developer can lose out to the developer across the street if word gets out about what he's doing. So all of this stuff is confidential, and architect number one won't share the designs with anybody unless the owner lets him. So there's no real way for architect number two to accidentally have figured out what the design intent was. It just doesn't happen. 11.10.3 is an interesting provision. It says that the owner won't withhold from your compensation if he has a claim against you. Suppose the owner has a valid claim saying that a negligent mistake that you made cost him $10,000 in order to have it redone. This says that the owner is not allowed to subtract that amount from what he owes you for fees, that these are separate concepts. He still has to pay you your fees, but he then has the right to seek return of $10,000 in his claim. As you can guess, most owners refuse to agree to this, and the language here is kind of unrealistic. It says that this will be true unless the architect agrees, well, what architect is going to agree to give up $10,000, or unless the architect has been found liable for that amount in a binding dispute resolution proceeding. That means unless the owner has already gone to court and successfully sued the architect, or gone to arbitration and won an arbitration award from him, which doesn't happen until the project is over, and then still takes a while. So as a practical matter, making the owner wait until the architect has been found liable is impossible. No owner is going to abide by that. So that provision usually gets stricken or changed. It's pretty unfair in favor of the architect. Then I put on the page that most people in this class cheer for, the final one. Thank you for having stuck with me over two long days of lecturing about this. Article 12, we're not going to spend any time on. You see how much is there? It's a blank. Article 12 is where you add in additional provisions, and I have lots of them. I have a standard rider that I put on all my B101 contracts that adds 20-something provisions that help or favor the architect, things that the document doesn't really consider, such as if this is a rehabilitation or renovation project, the architect is not responsible for doing destructive testing to find things that are hidden or not otherwise viewable, and that if such elements do arise, they will be treated as unforeseen conditions. It's just a clause that's true, sensible, and solves a problem that the B101 hasn't bothered to address. I have lots of clauses like that, and I use them with my clients on a regular basis, depending on whether they're appropriate for the project. Article 13 is general stuff about the contract. 13.1 says, this agreement represents the entire and integrated agreement. Those are magic words. Entire and integrated agreement means that this is the whole contract. If it ain't here, it ain't part of it. It means that there's no parole evidence necessary to identify what constitutes the contract. This is it. Remember, parole evidence is outside evidence, something, testimony or documentation to indicate that there's more to the contract than what appears here. This says there isn't. It says it supersedes all prior negotiations, representations, or agreements. That's important. So if you had a verbal deal with the owner that says you'll get paid a fee of 10% of the cost of construction, but then when you write up the contract, he persuades you to lower that to 8% of the cost of construction, and you reluctantly go along, the fact that you had a verbal agreement first is irrelevant. It's superseded. It's obsolete. The written contract controls, and any prior negotiations don't make any difference. And then it goes on to say that this agreement may be amended only by written instrument signed by both the owner and architect. How true is that? As you remember, it's not true at all. when we talked about modification of contracts 2 weeks ago, we pointed out that the same parties who signed the contract can modify it any time they choose. And they can modify it in writing, or they can modify it verbally. And the portion of a contract that says it's got to be in writing isn't worth the paper it's written on if the parties get together and modify it verbally, because they can modify away that clause too. Then there are checkboxes. For instance, this E201 document is the digital data protocol exhibit, which is the rules for exchanging electronic information. And you can, according to this, it's included in the contract automatically unless you take it out. Here in point 3, 13.2.3, is a place where you can list anything else that's part of the contract. The architect often lists its proposal or other kinds of things. It may be an exclusions document or any of a number of other things that may be important enough to include in the contract. Then we have signature lines. They don't have to be signed at the same time. They can be signed one and then given to the other. The first person who signs it is essentially making an offer, written offer, to the second person who signs it. And the second person is accepting that offer. And of course, because the contract has mutual promises, there is mutual consideration, and it is valid and binding. In general, the smart thing for you to do with your clients is for you to be the second to sign the contract, not the first. The reason is that unscrupulous owners, or sometimes just ignorant owners, may not only sign it, but modify it at the same time that they're signing it. And that creates all kinds of lack of clarity for you when you go to enforce it. Often, you don't scrutinize it when you get it back from your client, and you just stick it in the file. So the smart thing to do is to prepare it, send it to your client, and when you get it back, you first check to see if they've signed it, and if they have, then you read through it to see if they've changed anything. Because if they've changed anything, and you now sign it, you're agreeing to whatever they changed. There's a good procedure for making note of changes. Suppose they've taken out a provision of the contract. They put an X or a line scratching out a clause. Well, in order to confirm that you've seen and approved the change, it's often a smart idea to initial in the margin right next to that change, because that's, you know, any court will look at that and will wonder, why did you initial there? Well, obviously, because the change was there at the time that you initialed it, and you're just doing that to note the change. If you modify the contract that way and send it to your client, it's a smart idea for you to have your initials and a date on when you made that modification, so that nobody can claim you changed it after the contract came back signed. Just little hints. Any questions, concerns, or ideas about the B101? Good question. International standards. When you define the standard of care for an architect, you're defining it in part in terms of locality. It's actually defined as the levels of skill, care, and diligence that the average typical architect in the same location under the same circumstances would employ. So there is a standard of care for architecture in the United States. You might say there's a different standard of care for architecture in Chicago as compared to San Francisco, perhaps because San Francisco has different geotechnical type considerations. It's not so much that the standard of care is different, it's that the standard of practice is different because California has some additional needs. Now, it very well may be that the standard of care is different in Western Europe for architects than it is here. Now, I happen to know that in England it's not. The standard English or British, the Royal British Society of Architects or something like that, publish a form that is not identical to this, but is largely comparable. with the same sense of standard of care terms. In Western Europe, to a large extent, the British forms are used. They also have, I forget the French acronym for it, but there's an international set of forms that are used that are somewhat more ambiguous. In part, that's because Western Europe does a lot of work design-build, when the architect works for the contractor rather than for the owner, and therefore has slightly different set of responsibilities, because you don't need to protect the contractor from defective construction. The Middle East tends to use the British approach more than anything else. East Asia, China, and those areas have their own standards that I'm not all that personally familiar with. Sometimes they use English, the British standards. Sometimes they don't. Russia is an evolving market. It's all over the place. South America tends to use American standards. But in general, most of the developing world uses, if not this document, because this is more of an American document, they use most of the concepts in this document, so you won't find things so incredibly different. A fair portion of the midterm is devoted to the major concepts from the B101, so it's an important thing to know for the class. Bring the B101 with you when you take the midterm exam. You'll be wanting to look up things. It's not like I expect you to memorize anything that's in here. We will be talking about the A201 general conditions after the midterm, the first couple of classes. Those will be similar presentations to this, but those are elements from the construction contract. So there will be different subjects involved. In the meantime, thank you for putting up with two very dense days in the same week. Good luck staying awake the rest of the day. And I will see you next week to talk about copyrights and about starting your own firm. It's an unusual lecture, and in fact, I will pass out to you a proposal contract that you can use if you ever do decide to start your own firm. See you then.